So first, I would like to thank the organizer, in particular Massimo, for inviting me here. I'm not sure Americans realize how amazing it's for Europeans to be able to walk from his room to his office. This picture was taken this morning, and so I'm sure there's something interesting with to do with population genetics of fear of humans, because it is so striking that animals are not frightened by humans in the new world compared to the old world, that this must be genetically imprinted, I'm sure. And because they are migrating and things like that, might be interesting studies to be done in that field. I'm not a population geneticist, so I'm not sure. But so this is the second picture of my talk, and this is to explain that I should not be giving this talk. Actually, the PI in my lab who actually follow this project is Cosmin, and this picture was taken last week, so that explains why it didn't come and why I'm here. So to continue with the introduction, so it's a warning that indeed the major line of research of my lab for many years has been the study of RNA metabolism in eukaryotes. And we use the yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae and genomic tools to study these pathways. And so what I'm presenting today is really not the main theme of my lab. It's just a tool we developed for this type of functional studies. But I think, Massimo thought that it would be interesting to present it to you because it might have some relatedness with many of the things you are doing. So, as I said, I'm working on RNA metabolism since my PhD, in fact. I've been working on several pathways, splicing, export, degradation, and so forth. And so in the yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and obviously, I mean, in 1996, when the complete sequence was released, it was, as everybody in the field, shocked that out of the 6,000 genes that were predicted, only less than half of them had some function assigned, which means that when I say some function, it might be very vague. And so most of the majority of the genes which were predicted had no known function. And so it became a big challenge in the field to try to uncover the function of the genes. And among these genes, more than 2,000 genes showed RNA binding motif signatures. So they were potentially of interest for what we were analyzing. And so we got involved in genomic functional genomic studies to try to uncover the function of these genes.
It's about as much as drug transcription factors, right?
I think probably there's a little bit more even than transcription factor. I'm not sure exactly how many transcription factors there are, but it's about a similar order of magnitude anyway. So genomic studies, I mean, of course, since we are working with RNA, we did some transcriptome analysis, but not very many. We did a lot of protein-protein interaction studies by two methods, the two hybrids and the TAP purification, meaning that's a biochemical purification. And and there has been very large-scale studies of this type, and so we know a lot of the physical interaction between proteins in yeast. There are a number of bias, and we can discuss that, but this is probably anyway the organism in which the protein interaction maps is the of the highest quality in terms of sensitivity and specificity. But so we wanted to add another level of large scale studies, and by performing more functional studies, by performing a large-scale interaction mapping. So there have been several labs that have been involved in that type of analysis. And I'm going to present these different strategies afterwards. But in addition to the fact that most of the genes were actually of unknown function, another striking features of all the organisms in which that has been systematically treated is that if you delete or disrupt all the genes, you'll find that only a very small subset of these genes are essential for life. And this is true really for all organisms in which that has been looked at. And corollary to that, I mean, obviously the most obvious thing that you would think of doing if you had many genes with unknown function is you disrupt them and you look at what happens. And it was very disappointing in terms of information. Most of the time, the macroscopic phenotypes you observe will not tell you anything on the function of the gene. So we have to find other routes, and one of the routes is to find association with genes of non-function, for example. So that's why people did these large-scale protein-protein interaction and now genetic interaction mapping. So in yeast, there are indeed only 19% of the genes which are essential, and only 15% of the non-essential genes exhibit a fitness defect when they are deleted. So it means that the remaining, they delete them, and if you just grow them in a standard condition, you don't see any effect. So there are potentially several reasons for that. One of the most obvious reason is that the condition in which you test your mutant is not affecting the is not involved, is not challenging the function of the mutant. And for example, a very simple example is auxotrophy. If you delete a gene which is required for biosynthesis of amino acid, for example, if you are in complete medium, it doesn't really matter. The other reason for this observation is that cells are very robust machines. So they are highly, there is a very high amount of redundancy in the biological mechanism. And so when a pathway is not functional, the cell is able to find alternative routes to actually make its way to survive. And so one of the way to address these questions is actually to do this genetic interaction to understand the rules that govern this redundancy in the genomes.
So I thought there was a recent study in where they did a large panel of stresses and claimed that almost any gene you
can. Yeah, I'm talking to that at the end of my talk. We can discuss that. But that's actually a combination of finding the right conditions and affecting gene, because they use a lot of drugs, and so drug targets proteins, and so they affect the function of proteins, so it's like doing mutants. So so it's a combination of both. So, but that's actually indeed an interesting observation. So just to be sure that we talk about the same things, what are the type of genetic interaction we are going to be talking about? So the most obvious one is the so-called synthetic lethality, which means that, for example, if you delete one gene, there is no phenotype. If you delete another gene, there is no phenotype. If you delete both genes, then the cell dies. Or it grows slowly, which is then just synthetic growth defects. The most obvious example, if you have duplicated genes, The function might be essential, but if you take a gene, the other gene take over, I mean, it's sufficient. And you need to delete both genes. And in Saccharomyces cerevisiae has duplicated genomes, and I lost a lot of this duplicated gene, but still, there's a lot of genes which remains, which are duplicated. So part of the robustness of the system just comes from the fact that some of the genes which are essential are duplicated. So it's not very interesting in terms of function, but But this is actually not the majority of the cases. Most of the time, you'll find example of this type. So you have two, let's imagine this is very schematic, you have two pathways that actually converge to a single pathway, which is essential for the cell survival. So if you kill one of the pathway by removing one of the gene, doesn't matter, the other pathway actually take over, and but you need to actually delete genes in both pathways to actually affect the variability of the cell. So that relates to what I was talking about before. This is the redundancy of the system. So this is what the kind of things we want to find by this kind of analysis. We want to find genes which are not essential when they are deleted alone, but become essential when they are deleted together. Another type of interaction, which is also very interesting, is imagine that if you delete this gene, you delete the pathway, the function of this pathway, and so the cell survives because there is an alternative pathway, but it's still a little bit sick. Its fitness is affected. Now, if you delete this gene or this gene, if the pathway is abolished in both cases, the effect you are going to observe is going to be the same. And if you add the both deletion together, again, you don't do anything more. You're just killing the same pathway, and the fitness effect is the same. So this is one of the definition of epistasis, which is these genes are epistatic to each other, their effects are not additive. So now, aside from this very schematic type of interaction, one can say that when you affect a pathway which is not essential, but you will render another pathway, the rate limiting step for growth are going to change in the cell. It's not the same pathways that are going to be rate limiting when you are going fast or when you are going less fast. Okay, and so there is no obvious reason why if you affect two unrelated pathways, the effect might be perfectly additive. So you expect that you will get some kind of either synthetic aggravating effect or epistatic effect at some level. So we'll see that in more details in a moment. So more generally, I mean, these types of interaction, either aggravating or buffering, have been called general epistasis, and this has been, for example, formalized in this paper when they show that. So this is the fitness of the double mutant minus the fitness, the product of the fitness of the single mutant. So if it's equal to zero, it means that the effects are perfectly additive. But if it's negative, it means that you have a synthetic effect, aggravating interaction. And if it's positive, it's a positive, it's a buffering interaction or epistatic interaction. So this just kind of, these are just definitions. So the first large scale studies for these types of genetic interaction was performed by the Boone lab in Toronto. And they did this analysis in matrices. So first, of course, all these studies are going to use the systematic deletion library, which is available for yeast. And so they, with robotics, they cross single mutants And they have a way to select for haploid double mutants. And so then they compare for each double mutant they construct, they can compare the fitness of the double mutant relative to the single mutant. Of course, this works very well. So, for example, you see that this double mutant show a synthetic lethality effect. These mutants show a synthetic growth defect. But it's quite time-consuming because for one mutant, if you want to combine it with the complete set of mutation, you have to perform 6,000 crosses and so forth. And to test the growth of all the double mutants one by one. And so they have organized that in a semi-industrial way, so they are able to do a lot of this analysis. One drawback of these methods is that, at least in this in its original form, it was not very quantitative. So it was only scoring for lethality or growth effects, and no number attributed to that. And also, you would only detect aggravating interaction with this type of method, and not the buffering interaction. And then another guy in the Greenblatt Labs in Toronto, Nevin Krogan, actually develop a way which is derived from this analysis. So the precedent method is called SGA, for synthetic genetic arrays. And so he developed a more quantitative measure of growth by automatically computing the size of the colonies and affecting number to these. And also, one of the main differences with the HGA is that all the studies are done in matrices. So you have so each query gene is tested against same panel of genes. So you have a matrix of genetic interaction. And so this is more robust in terms of statistics and studies. So you look at a reciprocal interaction. And also what he introduces is the fact that if you do this in a very controlled manner and you measure this size very quantitatively, you can actually detect epistasis effect in this system. So if you look at the background which you consider as neutral, then epistatic effect will show up as double mutants that grow better than the single mutant in the same row or line. And so he was able to compute both epistatic and aggravating, buffering and aggravating interactions, and to attribute numbers of these. So this was a great improvement of the methods. A drawback from that is that you are limited to a limited number of genes. To do it in matrix, if you want to do it carefully, you would have to do one experiment with 6,000 against 6,000, and this is not really practicable today. So this analysis has been limited to the analysis of some functional pathways thus far. So what we wanted to do is to have a more to combine the benefit of both systems, to have a quantitative measure of the epistasis, to do it but that could be done on a complete genomic scale for each query gene. And so what we actually use is something that has been used for years in yeast, which is to take advantage of the fact that the systematic deletion library that was constructed by a consortium of labs introduced a sequence tag to each deletion. So if you have a gene which has been deleted with a selection marker here, each selection each deletion is marked by a specific by two specific tags. So this is a signature tag mutagenesis, and so you can actually analyze the presence of a given mutant in a population just by hybridizing. I mean, you perform a PCR of these tags in the population with conserved oligos that flank these tags. And then we have microarrays that carries all the complementary sequences to these tags. And you do hybridization to your microarray, and you can compute the relative amount of a mutant relative to the same mutant in another population. Okay, so if you have two populations, imagine you have a selection here and no selection here. Then there is one mutant which is missing here because of the selection. So the resulting tag is going to be missing in the PCR of this population. And when you are going to hybridize with, for example, here a red label and here a green label, then this corresponding spot on the microarray is going to be red, which means that this mutant here is absent in this population and present in this one. Okay, so you can do relative measure of the amount of given mutants in a population of 6,000 mutants. Okay. So you do it with a single mutant originally. So the idea now is to apply. So the selection will be here to introduce another one mutation to the population, one given mutation to the whole population, and to compare now the presence of a mutant of this single mutant when it is combined to this secondary mutation. To the same mutant in the population with only single mutants.
So how quantitative
can there be? So there is no.
You
see that. It's one of the main issues of my talk, in fact. Okay, so the way we do the introduction of a given mutant in the whole population is to use a system which is analogous to the system which is used by the SGA methods, but we developed another marker which is simpler to use, and we can do it in any kind of media. And so the idea is that you have so one of the beauty of the genetic of yeast is that you can grow cells in haploids or in diploids as you wish. And so if you start with a mutant that you combine with a population of a single mutant just by mating, and then you apply a selection for this marker here and this marker here. So this marker is going to mark the deletion of your query mutation, and it is under the control of a alpha haploid specific promoter. So we're going to express the antibiotic resistance marker only in haploid cells, alpha cells. So if you combine the selection for both these antibiotics and these antibiotics, you will select for haploid cells which carry the two mutations. So it's very simple. You can do it in liquid, in a complete pool of population.
If I understand,
okay.
But you're going to say now, I think, what about the rest.
Okay. So, the drawing, the scheme just before was with a single mutant here, but we do it with a whole population of mutation. And imagine one mutant here is synthetic lethal with this mutation, is going to be absent after selection of the double mutant. Okay? Does this answer your question?
Yes, that was
okay. And so one of the key points in the system is that the selection procedure has to be very standardized, because what we are going to do is actually compare population, so we want them to grow in exactly the same conditions.
Just to be sure I understand, so this is, if the two knockouts are on the same chromosome, you're depending on a recombination event?
We'll see that in a moment. But there's 16 chromosomes, so it's not very frequent. Okay. So they are grown in a multi-micro fermenter, so they are kept at constant OD, and we can control in a very specific manner the number of generation, number of doubling times. And this is very important. And so what we do is we do this with what we call the query population, the population of mutant in which we have introduced a given mutation, and the reference population, which is actually also combined to the same marker, but in a neutral, with quotation mark, position. And so we are going to extract the DNA, do the PCR, hybridize this microarray. And so when you have potentially buffering interaction, for example, it's going to be red because it's going to be more abundant than expected than the general population in the query population. And when you have a synthetic effect, so an aggravating phenotype, is going to be green. And so you can quantitate that.
But that assumes that the blue one by itself has a negative effect, no? Because otherwise, there's nothing to buff
them up. Well, of course, yeah, absolutely, yeah. If you want to see, if you want to see a buffering effect, you must have a phenotype, a growth phenotype to start with. That's absolutely true. And so the buffering interaction are going to be seen only when you have some growth phenotype. But because we do the growth in competition, and for a quite long number of generations, 18 generations, even very slight effects are seen at this level. So very rare that we'll see that example. We do have some example where we do not see much of an effect, but they are not so frequent. So if you compute, so what we get at the end is the signal for the red and the signal for the green, and so you do the ratio, and you would take the log 2 of the ratio, this as simple as that, after, of course, normalization. And what we get, if you now order the effect we observed with the genetic position of the mutation, so each vertical lines stand for the boundary of two chromosomes. So this is one chromosome, this is another chromosome. And to answer to your question, indeed you see that there are two very strong peaks that arise from here. And this peak is exactly centered on the position of the query mutation. And this peak is exactly centered on the position of the reference marker. And so this is very simply understood, because indeed, if the two mutants you are talking about are on the same chromosome, in order to have a double mutant, you need to make a crossing over. And so what we are just witnessing here is the genetic distance between the markers on the same chromosome. And so the closer the genes are, the less likely you are to have a double mutant. And so this does not occur at the level of the selection, but it's really occurs at the level of the crossing and sporulation. So it's not the same effect that you will be seeing here on here.
The reason you're seeing that, you're saying, is because those double mutants are just hard to make, because you have to, so you start with a very small subpopulation of them.
Exactly, yeah.
There might be very mild versions of this, right? That there, for other reasons, certain double mutants are more easy to make than other double mutants. So,
yeah,
there is generally some variation in the initial population.
Of course, for example, all the mutants, all the single mutants that affects mating or sporulation, we lose them. That's right. Okay, and then we do have effects which are general effects, but as you will see, what we're interested, the interest of the method is that we can do it on many mutants, And so the specificity of an effect is very much an issue. So to answer your question more specifically, it's true that we cannot exclude that the effects we are going to see are indeed selected during the growth of the population or during the mating and sporulation. But actually, we don't really care at that point, because we want to see relatedness between functional relatedness between genes, and this is, would be one type of functional relatedness. Okay, if this is specific for one pair of mutants, if it's specific for a single mutant, this is not interesting. But then it's going to happen for all the screen, and so it is going to be discarded as a non-specific effect. And we do have many of these, of course. Can be corrected to some extent, not too far, but just because it follows really the Haldane equation, and so you can compute here how many double mutants you are missing compared to what we would expect if they were not genetically linked, and we can correct for these values. So to get these types of things, okay. I'm not going to go into details. This is the kind of part where Cosmin would have been much more at ease than I am to explain how these calculations are done. So this is a typical example of, so once we have this type of results, what we would like to do is to see how reproducible are. So the interesting values are either below the zero line or above, and so these would be the aggravating interaction, and these would be the buffering interaction. So the first thing we would do is to try to see how reproducible is the effect, and so this is an example, typical example, where you compare the values for two independent experiments, completely independent experiments. And this is pretty well correlated. and you have strong effect like this one, and in both directions.
Can you remind me what exactly is being plotted?
There are two independent experiments, which were done on different days. And so what is plotted is the log 2 of the ratio of the colors on the slides. Okay, so we are just looking at the ratio of the amount of a mutant in a double in the population with a double mutation versus the single mutation. Okay, so the query is the double, and the reference is the single.
But the single that's supposed to be product. Sorry, when we define the epistasis, we're comparing a double mutant to the product.
Yes, so I can go, if you want, I can spend some time to explain to you why these positive value are, in most cases, buffering interaction. That will take some time. You want, I can do it. It's at the end of my talk for questions, but all of these interactions are not necessarily buffering. For example, this one, which is stronger, if you look at on plates, so you can test these by the standard way, by constructing the corresponding double single or double mutants and grow them on plates.
I think maybe it's important to clarify. So he has a whole library with single mutants of every gene, mm-hmm. and then he introduces a second mutation, and he compares now the fitness of the 6,000 double mutants with if you only do the second
double
mutation
to the reference,
right?
To the single mutants.
To the single mutant. So
the reference is the single mutant of the library. So we have
just one of the single mutants.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So
the one that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. But
so epistasis, strictly speaking, should be defined symmetric with respect to single mutations.
I would say general epistasis. It's not like the scheme I showed you where we have a given pathway with which is blocked completely or not blocked completely. I mean, this is not as simple as that.
In general, it should be defined symmetrically, right?
Yeah.
To the extent that we're trying to
we'll see that.
That sort of different.
So it's symmetric. I think we have to see the curves and why would the reason why we do see the positive value corresponding to that's the way to answer the question actually briefly, is that we are not growing the cell for the same amount of time, but for the same amount of generations. So we compensate for any effect of this of the querying mutant on the growth. Okay. So I have to show you the
now screen. I'm also confused. Is this thing that you're showing, is this related directly to epsilon or not?
Yeah. I'm going to show it because otherwise. Yeah.
Depends on the strength.
Absolutely, absolutely. So this is something that I did not plan to show because it's a little bit long, but I will do it. So this is the growth of the reference population, okay? This is the whole population. So
the reference population?
Yeah.
So
the single mutants. The single mutant population, okay? So this is a doubling time. It's not a growth, it's doubling time, okay?
But the single mutant, which single mutant?
All of them, all together. I have a population of 6,000.
Over 6,000.
Yeah, and I'm measuring how much time it takes for the population to double. Some are going to be just dead, and some are going to go fast, and so this is just the reference. So this is one mutant in the population, okay? So if...
I'm lost here.
Okay.
Because if I have a population of mutants with widely varying distribution of growth rates,
yeah.
I won't even have a straight line, right? My fastest growing mutant, I have many exponentials.
That's right.
I'll have a very weird curve, right?
Yeah, that's right. You should have a curve like that, okay? Because at some point, the fast growing are going to invade the population. But starting with the number of mutants we have and with 18 generations, you are not invaded by the virus. So I'm not saying it's a straight line. It's probably a line which is like that. You're right. But doesn't really matter for the demonstration. Okay, but you are right. So this is one single mutant in the population. Indeed, it's going to be growing this one slowly. Okay. This is another mutant which we know is in the same actually in the same protein complex and carries the similar function. So. This is a query mutant in this experiment. So this query mutant grow with these doubling times, okay? So during this doubling time, the expected number of doubling of RP6 is going to be this one. Indeed, what we observe is that it is buffered by the RP7 population, so the growth is the same. So this would be without epistasis, if the effect were additive, the double mutant would be additive, so the double mutant would grow slower than each of the single mutant, and here is this mutant is epistatic over this one. Okay, so this mutant grows as fast in the double mutant population as in the reference population.
But the so because is, I mean, I think the crucial thing here is that I also forgot is that you're putting also the reference population on your chip. So the reference population is some mixture of all these different strains in different proportions that have to do with how fast they grow. And now you add to this reference population a second mutation in everybody, and you grow them again, and now you throw it again on the chip. So what is competing on the chip is the double mutant with the single mutant from the reference population.
Absolutely, yes.
Right? So that at different spots, the reference population will have different concentrations depending on how much
absolutely, yes.
it has grown. And then you compare that ratio, which is the double mutant versus the single mutant in the reference, with the second mutant by itself, right?
Absolutely.
Therefore, it is like an epsilon measurement.
Yeah. So it means that if our... It's exactly that. I mean, you explained it better than me. So the this single mutant in the double population should grow like this if there was no epistasis. But that tree grows like this. So because we grow the two population not for the same amount of time, but for the same amount of doublings, so actually this population grows longer than this one. We stop it after this one. It leaves a time for the mutant to grow for this difference. And this is why this is a positive value, because you have more of this mutant in the double mutation than population than in the single population.
The key is that you're really growing 6,000 populations independently of each other, in a sense, because when you put them on the chip, you separate them out like
yeah,
that.
Of course.
Really what is that is what
allows them
to do.
Does it answer your question somehow?
We'll do this offline.
Okay. Anyway, we tested that, for example, in that case, on plates, if you grow, if you look at, or actually even on growth rates, in individual double or single mutants, and they do are epistatic to each other. They are not suppressor, for example. So
I have no problem with a sign. It's just not, but not with a number.
But see, it's not so much
the
chip.
Quantitative measure.
The chip can really
no.
look,
even the
well,
symmetry you know, right here is lost, right? So when we're saying that it grows more like
so,
one of the single mutants, it grows more like the slower one of the single mutants. So it already depends what we're, you know, which order we're comparing.
Absolutely, you are absolutely right that we are not measuring growth rates. This is a crude measure of growth in competition. There are ways that, and there are people that are playing with our data to try to see whether we can extract growth rates from these, and I'm not going to enter into this detail because I think it's not simple. One thing we could do is to take different time points, but it makes the experiment much more expensive and difficult, and so.
But I think this is not the hangout.
But I think it's not necessary.
Let's really do it online.
Yeah. Okay. So. Be back to where I was. So. Okay, so here I was. So this is an example where this strong positive value is not epistasis, it's a suppression, because as you can see, the single mutant here grows more slowly than the double mutant, okay? So the reason for that, we know it, actually, just to illustrate. The type of thing that to illustrate the fact that these genetic interactions, they are not as simple to explain or to rationalize that what I showed before. This gene is a ribosomal protein gene, and as many of the ribosomal protein gene in yeast, which needs to be very highly expressed, it's duplicated. It's one of the genes which have, for which the duplication, the ancestral duplication was kept. So if you remove this gene from the cell, then the amount of the RPS28 ribosomal protein is decreased by about a factor of two. And this is actually makes a translation rate limiting for the cell. It turns out that EDC3, which is the query mutation here, we had studied before, and we had shown that it is required specifically to, among other things, downregulate RPS28. So if you remove this, RPS28 actually goes up. So you restore so now cell is no longer rate limited by the amount of ribosome protein RPS28, and it grows better. So you do see a suppression phenotype. So just to show that genetic interaction we are going to see does not necessarily relate directly to common function. So what I showed you at the beginning with a very schematic view of ideal pathways, where you see that we have parallel pathways. To the biological interpretation of the genetic interaction is very diverse. Okay, it's not as simple as that. So we have to be very careful when we are going to do this type of analysis. We have to be confused by very simple models where all the genetic interaction will result from redundantness in the pathways. So now, let's see how these effects, which are his synthetic effect here, can be reproduced by constructing double mutants and growing them on plates, which is certainly not as sensitive as growing them in very fixed condition and in competition. And so we took a few of these and tested them. Okay, so is a query mutant, which has very no phenotype in this condition, a very little phenotype. And this is one of the strongest mutants showing a synthetic effect with EDT3. And when you combine both, you do have a very strong growth phenotype. This is, again, another example where you see that you have a slight growth effect, but it's not very strong. Another stronger effect. And for these two here, which are not as strong in terms of log 2 ratio, there's really nothing you can tell from the plate assay. So it means that in these conditions, these mutants, they don't exhibit any detectable interaction. So what does it mean? So does it mean that they are just background and not real? So one way to test that is to test whether there are these effects we observe in a competition in liquid are reciprocal. So we would take these mutants and we would test them for perform the same type of analysis and see what comes out of this screen. Okay. So if you take the two strongest one, so the gene that came out first is indeed EDC3, the starting, so it's perfectly reciprocal. But even for this, the one that show absolutely no effect on plates, even so, I mean, the clouds are much more restricted, so meaning that the effect you are measuring are very subtle compared to stronger effect like this. The one that came out first are still EDC3, which means that these very subtle interactions, which are not measurable on plates, they are reproducible first because these are each time two independent experiments, and they are reciprocal. Okay, so they are very likely to be real. And so you can do matrices like that, and the matrix is actually quite nicely symmetrical, so even for the epistasis effect. So it means that the data are reproducible, and the second the main conclusion also is that doing that in competition makes the assay much more sensitive to very subtle effects than we would do it by looking by 2x2 combination on plates. So this is to compare the effect we see with, so that this for the synthetic effect with our method on the x-axis with the EMAP method, which was described by Krogan. So we had a large number of double mutants in common in both experiments, both type of experiment, and it's quite nicely reproducible for so different setups of an experiment. I was quite amazed that this is so reproducible, to the exception that there is quite a large number of data that we have here that have no visible effect in the Krogan setup, in the EMAP setup, probably because these are weak effects which are only seen where things are in competition. And so now Krogan also using another setup where they grow their double mutant with reference mutation in competition with the GFP or RFP system to see more subtle effects. But it's quite, I mean, you cannot do it on a as genomic scale as this system.
So they did their experiments on plates?
Yeah.
So this is also a different environment, so.
Yeah. So you might consider this is not very strongly correlated, but I consider this is amazingly correlated. That it's very reproducible if you do two completely different types of experiments, and we do see a very good correlation between. I mean, this is an appreciation, but it's not very scientific. But yes.
So can you explain to me what is your interpretation on non-reciprocal mutation? That's, I mean, the terms that are not symmetric on the matrix execution as before, the previous couple of
years. Yeah?
Yeah, here it is symmetrical, but that might be the situation where it is not, in some cases.
Well, we do have some situation where we wouldn't see any reciprocal. At least the one which we have analyzed in more detail because we are interested in it's because the mutant in one of in the A met A population was wrong, was not a good mutant. It's not mutated somewhere, so the effect we were seeing was probably not. I mean, it was an artifact of the experiment. So I think. You expect them to be rather symmetrical.
Can you have that there's like some sort of interactions between the different mutants in your population while it's growing?
Yes, this has been observed in bacteria, so I guess this could but we are not. Well, the thing is the way we do the experiment. So this is in the microfermenters. So the medium is regenerated all the time. So if you would complement, for example, imagine a simple example where you would have an auxotroph mutant, and that would use some amino acids that are synthesized by nearby cells, and in that then I mean this is just a very schematic model, but. This type of interactions, because we are changing the medium continuously, that would be minimized. But I guess we cannot exclude that. Okay, so where am I? Yeah. So now, how to come back to the initial questions, we want to. Remember, our initial goal was not very fancy. It was just to have a way to try to have more functional information on mutants to try to assign a function. And one way to assign a function is to look whether your mutant has a phenotype on this scale which resembles a mutant that you know the function. Okay? And so one way to, so I don't remember why I showed you that, but so yeah, of course, if these mutants are indeed synthetic lethal, it means that they have a function which is in common, which is actually convergent with this pathway. Okay, so this is one way to say there is some functional relatedness between these two genes. So to be able to actually do this kind of analysis, we have to use standardized method of evaluation of functional relatedness between genes. And this actually work has been very very important for us because it provided the tools to do this kind of analysis. And the idea is that, so we are probably all familiar with gene ontology trees. So you have genes here that have related to different functions which have been annotated. The problem with this annotation, so the more upper you go, the more general the function is. So, for example, you have cellular process, okay? This is a function when you have this kind of information, it doesn't help you much. But then it goes to transcription from an APOE3 promoters and so forth, so to from very general to very specific, okay? The problem is the different level of annotation are not equivalent in the gene ontology library. And so what these people did is actually to look for each kind of pathways, they can imagine, or genes, levels of gene ontology annotation that would refer to an equivalent number of genes. Okay, to be able to compare things with, and so they provided what they call true positive pairs, gene pairs that are close at this level of are in the same, they're together in the same annotation branch in the gene ontology trees at the level they define for this pathway. And more importantly, maybe, they define false positive pairs, which are genes which are going to be related only by a node which is extremely high in the trees of gene ontology. So they are as far as possible in the gene ontology functional annotation. And they define a precision score, which is the number of true positive you have in a set of a genomic set of data versus the sum of the pairs they define.
Sorry, this is yeast.
Yes.
All blood yeast.
Yes.
So 9 × 10⁶, that's a significant fraction of all pairs of genes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
And 5 × 10⁵ is 10%.
Yeah. So. Indeed, if you do a random sampling of two genes in your population, the probability, the fraction of the time you'll find, the score you will define is given by actually the number of pairs you have in each of the two sets, and it's going to be 0.05, okay?
But does this include things like, a gold term is transcription factor. And so all pairs that are really pairs of transcription factors, they would be true pairs in this sort of annotation. Whereas maybe these transcription factors have, you
know. So once again, the key point of the study, I think, is that they define level of gene ontology annotation that relate to the equivalent amount of genes. Okay, so I don't know for this specific example whether this is pol 1 versus pol 3 versus pol 2, whether these would be separated or not, I don't know. But this is just to have a reference to be able to evaluate a different set of data with the same reference to see whether the precision of the how much of the pairs you can find by your set of data relates to pairs in terms of function. It's not to go, it's just a measure. We are not going to say this is and of course it's a relative measure. We are not going to say this is true at that level. I'm not going to say that if you are here in the precision, it means that the function is the same for time of 10. Certainly not. But we have a same reference for all the data which are generated by this type of analysis, and we can compare it to this gold standard. And this is just a comparison tool.
I guess the word gold that I'm so
it's a little clear what the standard is all. So what Eric is saying is that as far as hypostatic interactions are concerned, for example, it's a little obvious
but
that two transcription factors which are close in Go should be interacting any more than the transcription factor and its
if you take specific example, this is not going to work. But if you,
it's going to work for a general example. So
yeah.
If you have a category that says like, you know, biosynthesis of this specific amino acid, I can imagine that pairs from that category are more likely to interact with each other in some semi-direct way. But for other categories like transcription factors, you would not expect this at all, right? So it really sort of depends on.
Yeah, but we are not going to try to see whether a given pair of has this prediction precision or not. We are just comparing large set of data with a large set of annotation and with a standardized way, and see whether. So, if you do, and that's a strong bias. That there are several biases. One of the biases is that if you do a study only with transcription, for example, genes, then maybe actually you are off because transcription gene, the level at which the gene ontology has been set up is not appropriate for the transcription genes. That is possible. The thing is. The idea is that if you have large set of data that cover a large number of equivalent genes, function, or pathways, you have at least something to compare with. There is a more stronger bias in this is that, of course, this is highly circular because the annotation in the gene ontology is highly dependent on this type of analysis. So, of course, most of the many of the annotation comes from studies that are large-scale studies of protein-protein interactions, for example. So, of course, protein-protein interactions, there are better scoring in this type of analysis because it's a circular problem. Okay, they have been used to do to set the standard. So, of course, that helps. And indeed, they are very high in this type of analysis. Okay, some of them, not all of them, but it is certainly not perfect. I'm not arguing this is perfect, but we'll see that there are other ways to try to figure out how good for function prediction set of data is. But this is one of them which I found was quite interesting. So this is the level where you would be, and at least we'll see that this is informative for us because we can actually compare different methods of analysis of our data, the same set of data, and we. Might not be good for the set of data we have, but at least if you compare the same amount of the same kind of analysis done with the same data set, you'll be able to say whether your functional analysis extraction from your data set is relevant or not. You agree with that? Not completely. Okay. Anyway. So this is how doing 41 screen, this is in a pilot experiment. This is what we got if we put different thresholds for the synthetic genetic interaction defect. depending on the strength of the effect which we score, but also corrected for some specificity. So I'm not going to go into the details because I'd be in trouble. Kosmin would do it better than me. So we have different threshold of strength of the effects on growth. And of course, if you go low, you include a larger number of pairs, and these pairs they have a precision in this measure that you can actually argue it's not the best, but I'm not sure there is a better. It's quite low. It's much better than random, but still it's low. The high score, so we have much fewer pairs, genes, 120 something. But still, it's not. I mean, compared to a protein-protein interaction data, for example, it's not very high. The protein-protein interaction data are usually at 0.8.
That's where I have a problem. I'm very happy to see that the set is not random. And I think that makes perfect sense, and it's sort of a good measure to check it. But you know, the difference between 0.6 and 0.8, or 0.5 and 0.8, I really don't know.
At least it correlates with the threshold we put in the strength of the.
To the extent that when your threshold is low, you're picking up noise.
Of course.
It's sort of a good way of, you know.
I don't understand your.
That you're pulling out the subset which is noise.
Okay. Anyway. So this is the kind of so it tells you that if you take two pairs of genes which are synthetic, which show a synthetic effect, you have some functional some prediction of functional relatedness, but it's not of course. But you do not expect for synthetic lethality that. Two genes which are synthetic lethal are necessarily involved in the same functional pathway.
This works equally well for things that buffer as things that are aggravating?
No. Which I don't know why. You should expect it to work better, but indeed it's much worse.
So it gets much worse in what sense? In the sense that you are in the noise? Or
well, yeah. Or that data set, I think I don't have the figure, but it's close to the noise, yeah.
Which one? The aggravating or the buffering?
The buffering.
But then isn't this sort of suggesting that what you're really looking at is things that really directly physically interact? Right, because that will also explain why the protein-protein interactions are so high, right? They're 0.8 something or whatever, which is very high in my opinion.
Yeah, of course.
Given the problems with the definition of this, the go-term mediated, I would think that the real things you pick up are things that really directly, physically interact, and those you would expect to be, oh no, right?
No. Anyway, let's take it for what it is. It's just a comparison measure for a given set of data. Okay, I agree. It doesn't make sense to compare it to protein-protein interaction, for example. I mean, we're not expecting genetic interaction to be better or worse than protein-protein interaction for functional prediction. It doesn't just make sense to compare these. Okay, but can we still have a way to better extract functional prediction or functional association or relatedness from this set of data that we can do it from the direct genetic interaction? So that's the point of doing that. It's not to compare it with other data sets, it's to, for a given data set, to see whether you can do better in terms of function prediction as far as we use this the standard. And so this actually I think this is Jeff Baker that first described this, which is that to say a better prediction of functional relatedness is actually not to see with, I mean, to compare pairs of directly interacting genes, but rather to see the spectrum of genes with which a given mutant interacts with. And you see that in this scheme, all the mutants, this very schematic gene, all the mutants here are expected to be synthetic lethal with all these genes here. So you expect that by saying that all the synthetic X at this set of synthetic lethal mutant, Y as the same set of synthetic lethal mutants, and Z as the same set of synthetic lethal. And this is very likely thus that if these are specific to the three genes and not to other many genes, then that these genes are performing a very, very, are in the same functional pathway. And so this was described by Jeff Bucher, and I don't remember when, but with just a synthetic lethal interaction. Of course, you might imagine that this might be true for other type of interactions, okay? And that comes where this very, very subtle effect might be informative. So these are two independent experiments with the same co-region. Again, you see a very strong synthetic effect, some epistatic or suppressor effect, and a cloud, which is not a circle, okay? It's elongated, so it means that there is some correlation even in the very weak effect. So if you would apply the congruency approach you would of Jeff Bucher, you would use this information and just discard the rest, okay? Of course, you can add this one, that helps, but it might be interesting also to integrate this type of information. So we know that these are quite reproducible and reciprocal. So probably they carry a lot of information in terms of functional relatedness. If you do the same type of plot with now the same gene against a completely unrelated gene, as far as we know, you see that it's not correlated at all, okay? If now you take two genes which are actually paradox, they are alternative, they are coding for proteins which are alternatively used in a set type of complexes, the Trump complex, which is involved in degradation in the nucleus. You see that it's not as well correlated when you do the experiment with the two same genes, but still there's quite a strong correlation. It means that there is a lot of information in terms of function in this very weak interaction. Of course, these direct, very weak interactions, they have absolutely no meaning directly in terms of biology. I mean, just saying that if you take one mutant with which affects growth, and you combine it with another mutant which affects growth, there is very little chance that the two are perfectly additive, and the additiveness, the epsilon, is going to be dependent in specific of the pathway you are looking, okay? So now we can, with this 41 screen, we can compute profile of genetic interaction. We have numbers, so that's comprised the strong and small low number. But you can use this for just calculating simple Pearson correlation coefficients, as you would do, for example, for analyzing some transcriptome with transcriptome analysis with many conditions. And we are going to look for genes, among all these genes now, what kind of gene have the same type of interaction as with the 41 query mutation, okay? You follow? And so this is just random pairs, so that's Pearson coefficient correlation would be bell shape. This is actually, if you take the actual data, so at random. You take pairs, and you see that it's better than if you scramble everything. So there is some correlation between the way the most of the gene in the population interact with each other, which is actually what you expect, because some of the query gene, they do have very strong effect with many genes, which are not very informative in terms of function. And now we took advantage of the fact that when the systematic deletion library was performed, indeed this was done in a very systematic way, and all open link frame longer than 300 nucleotides were individually deleted. And a number of these very small open link frame actually are not genes, they are just a spurious open link frame. And some of them happen to overlap through genes, okay? So we know now from essentially comparison studies, you have heard the seminar from Bernard Dujon that they sequence a number of yeasts. So this gene, this type of gene, we know that they encode for selected genes, so they are interest function. But this type, which are now called dubious, because they are not conserved at all in evolution, so probably not genes. They're just spurious open link frame. But that's nice for us, because that provides to us two independent mutants for the same gene, okay? And so if you do, so now we are not talking about the query genes, we are talking about the complete population of mutants. And so we took a threshold of signal for the 41 screen, which was very low, and that's actually with this threshold, 1/4 of the mutants is included in your population. And if you now compare this independent mutation, and we have more than 200 of these in the population, how they compare in terms of genetic profile, in terms of Pearson correlation coefficient, and they are very, very high, okay? So which means that with only 41 screen, we were able to find a very high correlation in the functional profile for 1/4 of the mutant of the library. Okay, so of course, what we expect to do is to be able to do that for hundreds of query genes and to see how far we can go in functional association. So now another way to look at that is to say that, okay, most of the genes which are in the same complexes, they are involved in some kind of common function, of course. So ribosome proteins, they are all involved in translation and so forth. So we took probably the best set of protein-protein interaction data sets available for yeast. And we extracted the Pearson correlation for each pair of genes that are directly interacting in this data set. And this is the correlation we get, okay? So it's again a very, very strong correlation compared to random pairs in the data set. So it means that with very little screens, we are able to actually find functional association with much more, with a very large number of mutants, much more than we would do with direct genetic interaction. And so to come back to things that you don't like much, but maybe you like it better, if you compare it with the same data set, so that's going to be exactly the same data set. And now we look for, so we have also a threshold of, we can set different threshold of relatedness in terms of Pearson correlation. And this is what you will get. So it's exactly the same data set. You do much better in terms of functional prediction. It's very close to what we would get with protein-protein interaction and for twice as many genes. Which means that taking into account all these very small effects is likely to be able to generate, nevertheless, very specific genetic interaction profile that are representative of functional relatedness between genes.
So the correlation coefficients between, so you have correlation coefficients now between 6,000 square pairs.
3,500.
Well, yeah, but based on 41 data points, right?
Yes, absolutely. When we do that with a direct genetic interaction, then you have 41 against 3,500, which is much less, of course.
Yes.
So how, so you can represent this coefficient by plot like that. You see that you do cluster a gene with a common function, of course. These two genes are in the same complex, so you expect them to have very high coefficient correlation. And you can now try to isolate clusters which have similar profile. And so, for example, this is a cluster which obviously is actually dictated by very strong synthetic interaction. And these are all splicing mutation. But you can also have, this relates to the question you asked before, very nice clusters which are defined almost exclusively on epistasis. So the relationness of epistasis with the query gene doesn't really make sense in our data. But epistasis is very specific anyway, so for a given pathway. So you can even, in this case, distinguish between the large and the small hypernormal smear subunits. And more importantly, once again, even very weak effects, which have probably absolutely no meaning in terms of biology when taken individually, collectively, they generate this interaction profile, which in this case, for example, cluster very nicely the peroxisome gene mutation. And of course, none of these effects would be visible on plates. We test a sum of these because at the beginning we are interested, but there's absolutely nothing to be seen on plates, even in condition where, and this also, which is striking, is this is a condition where peroxisome is not really known to have any strong function. If you would put that in a medium where peroxisome would be important, even that in that condition, this double mutant between the query and the peroxisome mutants, they don't show any aggravating phenotype on plates. Okay, so what we can say here is that in principle we should be able to generate functional modules which we define by this cluster of genetic profile, and that between these functional modules, which very much overlap the protein complexes, of course, you will have the direct genetic interaction per se. So how does it look like in the real life? So this is with the 41 data set. If we took only the highest scores, the blue are the genetic interaction profile. So you see that you have indeed, so when you have a gray circle, it means that they share a this common gene ontology notation with a p-value here. Some of the modules we generate are a mixture of gene interaction profile and genetic interaction. So there are still some functional data in the direct genetic interaction, of course. Some are mostly genetic interactions, and otherwise, of course, the links between the different modules are almost exclusively given by the genetic interaction. Okay.
So, just so I understand. So gray dots are things that cluster based on correlation.
Yeah, so the cluster is done on just based on the links, either the 41 experiments. So either direct genetic interaction with the highest threshold, or the genetic interaction profile with the highest threshold. Okay, so we have what?
Something a bit strange here, because for all 5,500 choose two pairs, you have Pearson correlation coefficients.
Yeah.
But you only have 41 times 5,500 direct. So there are many, many, many cases where you cannot observe a direct effect because it's not in your screen.
Well, we do not observe an effect that we would consider maybe I miss your point. What I mean, the genetic interaction profile, many of them are actually defined by genetic interaction. Direct genetic interaction are very weak, that I would not, that are not in the data set of genetic interaction. If you take only the high score genetic interaction and you use that to do the congruency and to look for the genetic interaction profile, it's very poor. You do not gain much. If it's only if you incorporate all the very weak effects, that's then you have a very wide spread.
I understand that.
Correlation.
You have congruency scores for all pairs, but you have direct genetic interaction scores only for a small subset of pairs, namely the ones that involve the 41 for which you did screens.
Yes.
So that sort of biases what you could get.
Okay. No, that's right. If you would do the complete matrix, then probably it might look very different. I agree. That's right. That's a good point.
I'm beginning to understand why you want to use the gold standard. So what was troubling me was that if I were to compare a data set to the gold standard, I would achieve the highest score if it uniformly sampled the goal annotation. Right? That would score as one. So, and I don't particularly understand.
Repeat that. I missed your point. No, just repeat it. I think it's just go slowly.
you're comparing these two data sets and...
No, this is the same data set. Okay. Yeah. The two computations.
Yeah, let me fast forward. In a way, if I understand the whole philosophy here is to use this epistasis data, not so much for the purpose of actually measuring epistasis, but to use it as a tool to infer, in fact, annotation, right? And the gold standard for annotation is go annotation. Right?
Which is...
So we're really looking for as much concordance with go as we can get.
Right.
So that's why you sort of want to test it that way.
Yeah,
So in the beginning, I was thinking that we were trying to measure quantitatively epistatic interactions.
Oh no, yeah.
But of course, if that's not the goal, if the epsilon just stands in here for the proxy of some
that
some high throughput data one can collect and analyze and use it to. Put unknown genes into Go categories, but then clearly comparing to this Go sampling is the right thing. So I
do think that probably this is something that somebody is interested in trying in Finland is to see how we can use this type of data to actually convert our log-2 ratio in growth rates. That's what you are saying, but we are not using growth rate, we are using very crude measure, and that I'm absolutely agree with that. I mean, we are not measuring growth rate, and I do agree with that.
Well, it's not only growth rate, it's what
what you do with it afterwards. So when you start looking at correlations of these profiles to identify congruent genes, mm-hmm. right? And then you want these congruent genes to be sitting in the same category. So
yeah.
But I would almost argue that the if two genes are very congruent, according to your definition, that's a better definition of functional similarity than whether they go in the same category or not. Because it really says that the distribution of fitness effects with all the other genes is very, very similar for these guys.
Yeah.
And I would say that's almost the definition of being very similar in function.
But one of the nice things is that, indeed, on a large scale, the gene ontology annotation is very much based on the large-scale protein-protein interaction, okay, which is very different.
Is that really true? Because, I mean, doesn't this explain the fact that the protein interaction data set scored higher on the
of course, of course.
Because the annotation was built on the database in Frisco.
I thought many, many of these things are based on, you know, you recognize some specific domain and you say, aha, this is alcohol dehydrogenase, so I map it to that category in the goal hierarchy.
Yeah, I have not done the, I mean, I know if...
The interaction.
I don't know if anybody has actually...
Have they combined this?
I don't know how... that would be interesting to do, to see in the gene ontology annotation what is the proportion of data from large scale and from...
Right.
I don't know, but okay. But of course. Anyway, there has to be some circularity in the measure. But to which point I don't know. At least, okay. So it's very reassuring to see that actually indeed congruency, which matches as we have seen pretty much complexes, they do much better in this with the gene ontology gold standard, whatever you want to call it. Than the direct interaction, because that's exactly what you expect, okay? Because if the gene ontology is part protein-protein interaction, then that should fit anyway. Okay, so I have some time left. I'd like to extend these notions to something we are not doing, but that many other people are doing. Of course, we are looking at relatedness between mutation. If you believe that a good drug, at least, is going to target one or a few protein functions, then you expect the effect of a drug to mimic the effect of a mutation at some level. Okay, so imagine you have a drug that inhibits a kinase. You might expect that the phenotype at the molecular level you will get will be similar to a mutation of the kinase. Okay. One of the interests of that is, of course, that the experiment is quite easy to do. You have your population of mutants. Same population, single mutant, or they can be even heterozygous diploids, and you grow the population with or without drug, and then you do exactly the same kind of things. You do the PCR, you hybridize under microarray, and you see that you have some mutants that make the cell highly sensitive to the drug, and some mutant that make the cell very resistant to the drug, okay? Of course, you have other type of secondary effect that you would not have with a mutant, for example, the multi-drug resistant genes, which, for example, are involved in efflux of the drugs. You will see it only with the setup, permeases or whatever. I mean, there are a number of differences that you expect, but you would expect to have some level of relatedness between the type of profile you see with a drug and the type of profile, genetic profile you see with the mutant.
So So this experiment, you start again with a population where you have where all 6,000 single mutants are present.
Yes, except if you are doing, except if you are using haploid cells, then or homozygous cells, or you don't have the essential, but otherwise, yes.
So how can we make sure that every of these mutants is present at the same initial fraction?
Well, that's a concern, and indeed, but it doesn't really matter because you are going to measure the difference between one population to other population for the same. You start with the same population. In fact, so to do these pools, what we do, we grow the cell, the mutant individually to saturation, and then we pool. So they are roughly at the same amount. There's a high level of variation that comes not from actually the amount of starting materials for each mutant, but from the fact that the TM of the oligos varies. And so this is at the hybridization level that there is two logs of differences, unfortunately. That's one of the problems of the method. But so actually the variation of the initial amount of mutants in the population is negligible compared to this problem. Okay, so there are a number of papers. Of course, this is very important for the pharmaceutical industry, this type of experiment, because if you extract natural compounds for many organisms and test their effect or any kind of compounds, synthetic or natural, on the growth, you want to see, for example, compounds that would inhibit growth, if you want to find an anti-cancer agent, for example, I'm just taking an example. But you have no idea after this kind of screens what is the target of your compound. And if you do that on a very large scale, and once again, you might expect that if a drug targets the same protein, the same pathway, the profile that this drug will have in terms of genetic interaction should be equivalent. So it might be a very fast and a cheap way to just say, okay, these four compounds, they are basically doing the same thing, and we don't have, because usually people are using mixture of extracts and have no idea what they are testing, what they are looking for. So it might be potentially very, very efficient way to say, okay, these five compounds, they are doing the same thing. Let's concentrate on this one, okay, try to see what it does. And if it, so you can also tell you that don't spend time with this compound because actually it's exactly the same profile, does exactly the same thing as a pump compound which is already used, so probably it's not worth doing it. So there are very, very high level of activity in this field. These are a few of the large-scale recent studies. And so in this series, again, what they are most interested in is to compare compounds to compounds. So okay, so they do have the same kind of congruency methodology. They are looking for to find compounds that have genetic profile as much different as possible, because then it's a new, they find a compound that targets a new protein, a new target. But we took actually some of these data sets, some of which are actually publicly available, and we took this one because, I mean, these ones are extremely recent, but we could do the same with these. And we do the same kind of clustering, but we incorporate our data, okay? So I agree, things are not done in the same conditions, but still, let's see how it looks like. And so I don't know how biologically significant it is, but you can immediately see that by eye, you can distinguish the genetic interaction mapping data from the chemical profiling data. They are not the same kind of profile. And more specifically, what can be found is that the clusters that are defined by the chemical profiling are more broader pathways, like I think this is a mitochondrial function or something like that. Very, very broad. So I have no explanation for that. It's just an observation. And there are two possibilities, one which is not very interesting, which would be to say that, okay, the experiment has been done in different setups, and this is just a bias of the experimental setup. And so we are going to do some of these to try to see whether this holds in our hands as well with the same setup. The other possible explanation, which is more interesting, is that the postulate that drugs mimic mutants is just not correct. I mean, drugs probably very rarely target a single protein. Of course, this is also a major issue for the pharma companies, because one of the main problems they are facing is secondary effects. So if you could tell by a cheap assay that a drug has a very very narrow target, a very specific target in the cell, in contrast to a very broad effects, that would be very, very interesting. Also, obviously, what you would like is to have a drug that have an effect on much more specific pathway. So once again, this might just comes from the fact that the assays with the drugs are performed usually, at least in this set of data, at a concentration where the effect on growth is about equivalent. They see an effect on growth, that's why they test the drug. They know they are inhibiting growth, and those they set up an experiment where they know they have, I don't know the exact figure, but I would maybe, let's say 10% inhibition of growth. Okay, and all the and they do that for all the drug they are using. They are going to be in a concentration window where there are a given effect on growth. So it's possible that, of course, when we do the same type of experiment with a mutant, we cannot control this. I mean, some of the mutants have seen strong effects, and so they show a lot of epistasis. Some have weak effects, so they are much more specific for a few mutants. And maybe that's the one of the reasons why the diversity we get gives a more detailed definition of the functional module that it seems the chemical profiling would give. We don't know that yet. This is a possibility. But the other possibility is that the chemical, there are, unfortunately, most of them targeting a very limited number of enzymes, of proteins. And so maybe the chemical profiling is less complex. I mean, will not allow you same level of complexity the functional analysis as genetics would do. Against this somewhat sad idea, is indeed the paper you were referring to at the beginning, which is the very recent paper in Science, where they have done these experiments at a very high scale. So they altogether, so they tested either homozygous mutant, either haploids or diploid homozygous, or diploid heterozygotes. Okay, and so they did. They used, I think, 400 different drugs, and they did that with several concentration and in different conditions, like pH, temperature, and a variety of conditions. So, and the striking result of this paper, which was, I think, quite unexpected, is that if you do that, you finally find that probably all of the genes you can find a phenotype in this type of experiments. So, because most of the data rely on the effect of drugs, that would argue that drugs have more broader targets than what the previous slide might have predicted. So the other thing is, it also means that in terms of functional prediction for genes, probably this is indeed a nice way to go, because if we can find phenotype in rather standard condition, in a completely exotic, like going on a grape or something like that in the winter or whatever, then it means that some functional information is amenable to experimentation with these rather simple procedures. And so I think that's encouraging. Okay, so once again, this is not the main theme of my lab, and so a limited number of people which were actually involved in this project. Almost all the wet lab experiment work was done by Laurent de Courty, the technician. Christophe Malabat did most of the bioinformatic analysis for essentially the analysis of the microarrays, and Cosmin did all the subsequent bioinformatics analysis for congruency and looking for correlation with gene ontology and so forth.